It's not just a divorce story. Bill and Melinda Gates are critical to global philanthropy.
They act as a quasi-governmental entity, given the scope of the wealth that they have committed to the foundation.
Also today, France tackles elitism on campus. Emmanuel Macron is closing the school attended by himself and two other recent French presidents.
It's more like a place where you meet people, build your network. In terms of content, it was not good.
I'm Marco Werman, and after 6 months at home, Greeks are finally going back to restaurants and bars. With a catch, no music.
We can't drink without music. We feel, I don't know how to say.
Uncomfortable.
Yes.
We feel like something is missing.
Yes.
Cafe Society without song, all of that and more, today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for joining us today. We begin with news from Mexico City, a tragedy on the busiest public transit system in Latin America. A metro overpass collapsed last night in the Mexican capital. Two subway cars crashed onto the street below. At least 23 people died. More than 70 people were taken to the hospital. Jorge Valencia is the world's Mexico City correspondent and joins me. Jorge, can you give us a brief explanation of exactly what happened and where it happened?
Yes, this happened in one of the southeastern corners of Mexico City, and it was a metro train that was traveling southeastbound at about 10 p.m. when an overpass collapsed, sending two cars from the train tumbling onto traffic. And we know this because the metro system released a very dramatic video in which you can see the train cars collapsing onto the vehicles that were traveling below.
A really terrible incident. And what do we know about the people who were traveling aboard the train?
We know a little bit about them. Many were able to climb out of the rubble after the wreck. Some people were stuck and were rescued. Most people were in the age range of being in their 20s to their 50s. And a handful of people early this morning were actually still missing. I want to play you an interview of a woman called Marisol Tapia with a reporter from the Reforma newspaper. And early this morning, she was still looking for her 13-year-old son, Brandon.
Él venía a estas horas más o menos.
Hablé 5 minutos antes con él.
¿Y qué te dijo?
Que ya venía, que estaba en periférico.
And what's going on there, Jorge?
Marisol is telling the reporter that she had spoken to her son just 5 minutes before the wreck. He was actually with his father, and the father was taken to a hospital, but that she had checked with ambulances, she had checked with all the hospitals where people were taken to, and she had not been able to find him. And last that I checked this morning, she still had not been reunited with her son, Brandon.
Really tragic. Do authorities know why this bridge collapsed? Is that understood yet?
They are not saying very much about this yet. Of course, this is the central or a central question. Mayor Claudia Sheinbaum spoke at a press conference for about 30 minutes this morning, and she limited her responses to saying that this is under investigation.
Mi posición es que tenemos que llegar a la verdad de cuáles fueron las causas que provocaron este lamentable incidente, y que para ello necesitamos expertos, tanto de la Fiscalía General de Justicia.
Mayor Sheinbaum here is saying that she wants to get to the truth of what happened, but that for that we need an investigation. So she says that there will be investigators who are from the Mexico City government and also from outside. In fact, she said that they're going to go to foreign investigators, foreign engineers, to come in and do an inquiry into what happened. Many of the questions during the press conference centered around whether was there any impropriety during the building of this rail line? Again, it's relatively recent. It went into service in 2013. There were also questions about whether these overpasses, these bridges that carry the trains, if they had sustained any substantial damage that had been neglected after an earthquake in 2017 that shook the city and caused a lot of damage to buildings. Those are all things that many people are wondering about and are very reasonable questions, because in Mexico and in Latin America and in so much of the world, corruption plagues government big time. So these are all things that people are asking at this point, but that we still don't have the answers to right now.
As you said, Jorge, this is one of Mexico City's newest subway lines, built to reach a part of the city that did not have close access to the subway. How much does Mexico City subway penetrate remote parts of the capital? And generally, has the subway grown as Mexico City has grown?
The Mexico City subway system was inaugurated in 1969, and it has grown with the city, but the city has grown at a much faster pace. And surveys have shown that 20% of the people who commute in the Mexico City area commute for more than 3 hours every day.
Wow.
And a ride on the metro is only 25 cents. So if you have a very long distance to travel and you don't have a car, this is what you are going to use. And even in the pandemic, there are still many, many people who are using it. In February, 50 million passengers boarded the Mexico City metro. And these are the most recently available figures. And that's not even half of the number of people who used it before the pandemic. I mean, I was one of them. I used it on a regular basis. It's fairly packed and sweaty, and it's sort of a part of the experience of living in the city. And so very likely the people who were traveling aboard this train last night were people who needed it and who were using it to return home after a long day of work.
The World's Mexico City correspondent, Jorge Valencia, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Nearly 1.2 billion doses of the coronavirus vaccine have been administered worldwide. An important note here, more than 8 in 10 of those shots have gone into the arms of people in high and middle income countries. One reason for the disparity, rules on vaccine patents. The Biden administration, as well as many governments around the world, are under intense pressure to temporarily waive patent rules on COVID-19 vaccines. Joining me to discuss this is Thiru Balasubramaniam. He's with the NGO Knowledge Ecology International. They focus on the effects of intellectual property on public health. So, Thiru, this is precisely what your organization looks at. How would lifting patent protections on various vaccines help get more shots into people's arms faster in poor countries?
A waiver on patents under WTO rules would free up idle manufacturing sites all across the world, including in countries such as Canada, Pakistan, Bangladesh, to help scale up manufacture of COVID-19 vaccines.
We're seeing the Biden administration under intense pressure from Congress and overseas governments to join the effort to temporarily waive patent rules on now several COVID-19 vaccines. The White House is now entering into talks with the World Trade Organization. How much of a game changer would it be if the U.S. gets behind this idea of temporary waivers?
It would be a significant game changer at the WTO. The WTO operates by consensus, and currently there are about 60 official co-sponsors of this waiver proposal. And there are a few who've been blocking passage of the waiver: the United States, the European Union, Switzerland, Canada, and Australia, to name a few. And if the United States were to switch their position, it would have a significant effect.
Yes. So what is the expectation at these World Trade Organization meetings this week?
Given that the WTO is meeting tomorrow and on Thursday to discuss this very topic, I think we should see some sort of clarity in position of the Biden administration.
So there's an understanding among some representatives of these WTO meetings what's at stake here. But so far, the U.S., Japan, and other countries have opposed a temporary waiver on vaccine patents. So does Dr. Anthony Fauci. He says it would actually slow down access to the vaccine. Do you buy that argument?
Dr. Fauci's statement, you know, if I was being charitable, and I would like to be charitable to Dr. Fauci, I think he was saying that, you know, if this just ends up in protracted lawyering over the next 3 to 9 months, let's say, how will that help get vaccines out the door to those who need it? Maybe if one is not charitable, you know, maybe he's not behind the idea of the waiver. But just to emphasize, this would be a temporary waiver.
So Dr. Fauci has that view, but many people say if the pace of vaccine deployment is not sped up, what we're seeing right now in India is going to happen in a lot of other places. Do you think that's true?
I must confess, I'm not a vaccines expert, but I think I would have to agree. And, you know, we've seen it in other manifestations a few months ago in Brazil, South Africa, also the UK, and, you know, like the United States in the first, second waves. But I think what we're seeing in India, it's so grim and it's so heartbreaking. And I think that is the fear of pretty much everyone.
So South Africa is one of the countries leading the charge for the WTO to issue a temporary waiver on patent protection. Is South Africa's experience pushing for generic HIV drugs 20 or so years ago one reason for that?
Yes, Marco. I think that certainly resonates with South Africa in terms of their experience battling AIDS 20 years ago. And I think you know, since they were one of the pioneers of moving this debate at the WTO 20 years ago, it is only fitting that when they saw the current pandemic, they basically articulated that these trade rules were not fit for purpose to deal with COVID. So that is why they put forward this proposal with India last October on the temporary suspension of intellectual property rules for COVID-19. One thing to remind ourselves about is that a lot of the R&D that went into the development of these amazing vaccines was underwritten by public funding, including Moderna, for example. And a lot of, you know, mRNA technology was funded by BARDA and DARPA in the United States. One policy failure was that the public funding of vaccines, they were not sort of baked in with access provisions to ensure the sharing of know-how. And that is something going forward into the future that I think countries and societies and institutions should reflect on.
Thiru Balasubramaniam with the NGO Knowledge Ecology International. Thiru, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
In Greece, before the pandemic, this is what you typically hear walking down the tavern-lined streets of Athens. Traditional Greek music, live, people singing and dancing. That was another time, before the pandemic. Today, Greece is coming out of a national lockdown. Bars and restaurants closed since October are welcoming people again, outside. Last night, Greeks flocked al fresco to eat and drink together for the first time in 6 months. The sound of dinner, dogs barking, lots of chit-chat, but you didn't hear any music, not recorded or live. That's because the Greek government has told establishments that is one thing that is still off-limits, for now. Authorities hope this discourages people from singing along and raising their voices over the music, because, as we know, singing and loud speaking can accelerate the spread of the virus. Now, for Greeks who've been cooped up for months, they're not exactly fired up about this wrinkle, like this group of 20-somethings at a bar in Athens last night.
I think it's terrible. Yeah.
We feel so sad, and we want music. We can't drink our cocktail without music. We feel, I don't know how to say.
Uncomfortable. Yes. Yes. We feel like something is missing.
Yes.
I totally hear that, but just a little more patience. In 2 weeks, the music ban will likely be lifted when Greece is also supposed to reopen for tourism. Until then, this group says they might be bringing their own speaker to the bar, not to play anything that might conjure Zorba necessarily. Nope, their tune of choice.
Love My Way.
Love My Way.
Sing it. Love My Way. It's in your road. I follow.
The psychedelic furs, still big in lots of places, including Greece. Coming up later in the show, France is doing away with one of its elite schools. Some applaud the move, but also ask what replaces it. And we hear from displaced Syrians living in Turkey. They're looking at the upcoming elections back home in Syria with a lot of skepticism, but also with some hope for the future.
Maybe we can't go to Syria, but maybe our children will do this. No dictator, no regime will last forever.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. When it comes to refugees, President Biden is reversing course again. The president has now quadrupled the number of refugees allowed into the U.S. within the next 6 months. The cap now stands at 62,500. President Trump had set the number at 15,000, a historic low. To discuss this shift, I'm joined by Hans van der Weerd. He's with the International Rescue Committee, the IRC, a global humanitarian aid and relief organization. Hans, what do these new numbers mean for already vetted refugees who've been waiting to get to the U.S.?
It is really good news, Marco. It means that they can actually come to the United States. As you know, many refugees were expecting to come for a long time. It couldn't happen. Their families, many of them who are already in the United States, were waiting for them, were, you know, deeply concerned. So this decision of the president is really welcome news for refugee families. It's also a very good decision for America.
And what about refugees who have not yet been vetted? Or are we looking at a waiting list of people that will automatically get to that kind of 62,500?
Well, what the U.S. basically have said with this decision, what the president has said with this decision is, first, we're going to resume refugee arrivals to the United States and are going to make sure that we come as close as possible to the target of 62,500. But what the president also said was that he reconfirmed his commitment to a higher number next year. And in order to reach that higher number, it means that the U.S. will have to start the vetting process overseas again.
So many refugees, as you said, were expecting to come, had been waiting to come with reserved seats on planes, and then literally had their flights canceled when this number did not reach what people were expecting. What have you heard from these people?
So obviously, I mean, we heard that they were very concerned. They didn't know whether they were going to go to the United States. They had planned on coming to the United States. As I said, many of these refugees have family members that are already in the United States that were also deeply concerned and were wondering whether they, you know, going to be ever reunited by the president. And because people had such high expectations of the Biden administration, this was very hard on them. So I expect that a lot of people, you know, really have sighed relief and are now making plans again and can think about the future again.
So I know that refugee and resettlement agencies like yours, the IRC, adapted to the record low numbers under Trump. What are you preparing to do now in the next few weeks and months as this number of refugees increases?
Yeah, under President Trump, there was still a lot of work for the refugee agencies, really, you know, supporting the community that was already here and helping them deal with this uncertainty and with the very negative stereotyping that that took place under the previous administration. Now, of course, with this administration being much more positive, we are talking to community organizations and making sure that they are ready to receive larger numbers of refugees. We're talking to school districts, letting them know that refugees will be coming again. We're speaking to employers, you know, who are really keen to work with refugees as well. So really what our work at the moment is really about preparing the community for the new arrivals that will come. And of course, also making sure that our own organizations have enough staffing members, etc. Yeah. And as I said, you know, we can't start soon enough with this work because of the families that have been waiting for such a long time.
That's Hans van der Veerd with the International Rescue Committee speaking with us about new refugee numbers in the U.S. Hans, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
What can be done to make higher education more inclusive? The U.S. is grappling with that question. Some colleges are scrapping standardized tests, which critics say favor families with money. In France, President Emmanuel Macron is taking things a step further. He's ordered the definitive closure of one of the country's most elite schools. But as Rebecca Rossman reports from Paris, the real measure of change will lie in whatever replaces this French institution.
It's the alma mater of three of France's last four presidents, including Macron himself. L'École Nationale d'Administration, or LENA, is shutting its doors for good. It was founded by Charles de Gaulle at the end of World War II to train future generations of the country's top civil servants, or managers in the public sector.
Je pense que pour faire la réforme que j'évoquais, il faut supprimer, entre autres, LENA.
In order to make the reforms I want, Macron casually announced 2 years ago, we have to close LENA entirely. This was at the height of France's Yellow Vest protests. The movement attacked Macron as a president of the elite with an administration that was out of touch with the everyday needs of the country's working class. About 30% of Macron's cabinet are LENA alumni.
Pour bâtir quelque chose qui fonctionne mieux, tel que je l'ai dit, il faudra...
We need to abolish LENA and build something better, Macron said. Earlier this month, he made good on that promise. The school's 2021 cohort will be its last. Benoît Floch writes about education for the French newspaper Le Monde.
Au début, quand De Gaulle a créé l'école, il voulait vraiment que la haute fonction...
He says when De Gaulle opened l'ENA in 1945, his goal was to make senior civil service positions accessible so that anyone, regardless of their background, could have a shot at a top government post.
On est bien obligé de reconnaître que l'école, elle a échoué de ce point de vue-là.
On that level, he says l'ENA was a total failure. Even though admission is technically merit-based, less than 1% of the 2020 cohort came from a working class background.
Elle reste malgré tout une école qui accueille...
Generally speaking, Floch says, it's a school of the bourgeoisie. Adeline Baldacchino was a part of the exception when she was admitted to l'ENA 14 years ago.
ENA was something very distant, very difficult to have access to.
The daughter of a bank teller and a homemaker. After college, she took the risk and applied anyway, per the advice of her teachers.
It was something very intriguing and at the same time something very attractive because in a sense it made you think that if you could go there, then you would have a very interesting job at a high level. And then maybe you could even change the world or at least France and how it works.
But she says once she got into the school, she was disappointed by the course material. Or lack thereof.
It's more like a place where you meet people, build your network, learn to know how the administration works. In intellectual terms, in terms of a real training, in terms of content, it was not good, not at all.
In other words, it was 2 years of networking with top civil servants, mostly other LENA alumni coming from affluent, privileged backgrounds. Macron has promised that LENA's replacement, the Institute of Public Service, will be different, but the details are still unclear. To increase diversity at the new school, he set up a program called Talon, which will set aside a certain number of placements for students from underprivileged backgrounds. Jean-François Amadou teaches management at the Sorbonne.
Effectivement, c'est un changement peut-être plus important en définitive.
He says the Talent program is an important change, but wonders whether students that participate in it will be given the same opportunities when it comes to finding jobs after graduation. Others question more generally if the new school is just LENA by another name. But Macron deserves more credit, says Benoît Floch of Le Monde.
Quelques présidents de la République ont essayé de s'y attaquer et ils ont renoncé.
Other presidents have talked about closing LENA, but ultimately they gave up, he says. Macron followed through. That in itself should be seen as a sign of progress. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Paris.
You're listening to The World. The Olympic Charter bans discrimination of any kind at the Games. Upcoming host nation Japan has no laws to protect the LGBTQ community. Politicians, activists, and athletes are hoping these Olympics will be a galvanizing moment.
The country that I love so much, I really hope can step up on this front.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. They are two of the richest people in the world, the ultimate power couple, but now they're splitting up. The divorce of Bill and Melinda Gates is about much more than one relationship, though. It could have huge implications for global philanthropy and public health.
The Gates Foundation is the most important and most influential private foundation in the world, in particular on the global scene.
That's Stanford University's Robert Reich. He's the author of Just Giving, Why Philanthropy is Failing Democracy and How It Can Do Better. Reich describes Bill and Melinda Gates' foundation this way.
They act as a quasi-governmental entity, given the scope of the wealth that they have committed to the foundation and the scope of their work across the globe.
Put a number on it. What is the scope of that wealth that's gone into that foundation?
It's in the neighborhood of $50 billion in the foundation, which means that they spend annually or, you know, grant annually something on the order of $5 to $7 billion a year. And of course, that amount of money, because a good portion of it is invested in the market and the markets have gone up over the past 20 years, that amount has continued to grow. So there's an annual spending of between $3 and $7 billion a year.
So I know education and public health are two pillars of the Gates Foundation's work. What examples are there of how they've made a positive impact or contribution in either of those two sectors?
Well, the most obvious one is that the Gates Foundation, far more than many governments and every other foundation that exists, has been ahead of the curve on pandemics. Bill Gates has committed philanthropic funding to investigating the causes of pandemics and to try to stimulate global spending on prevention and containment. And I don't mean just in the past year and a half of the coronavirus pandemic, but years earlier. It's a fantastic example of how someone with philanthropic assets can stimulate the work of public health systems to do a far better job than, in fact, they've turned out to do.
So, Rob, where has the foundation misstepped?
The Gates Foundation, as any foundation, is an exercise of power, mostly unaccountable power by wealthy people. And it's an interesting feature of our global sort of political scene that Bill and Melinda Gates appear on the global stage as if they were elected officials. And the kind of power they wield, we can decide whether it's positive or negative, but we shouldn't pretend that it's simple benevolence. The Gates Foundation is one of the most powerful players, certainly in the world of global health and more generally across the globe, but that's a power that's exercised in a non-democratic way. You can't unelect Bill and Melinda from the foundation.
Well, you described earlier the foundation as quasi-governmental, but it is not government. It's a private philanthropic foundation. Explain what you mean.
Take the Gates Foundation's education grant making in the United States. They have a particular view about what a better path for public education would be. You can agree or disagree. But if you disagree and you wanted the Gates Foundation to shift its strategy in the public school that you happen to have your kids in, there's nothing you could do except write a letter to the editor. Whereas if you disagreed with the school superintendent or the governor, you could, at the next election, vote the people out of office. There's no voting Bill and Melinda Gates out of office. They're there as long as they wish to be. The Gates Foundation has exactly three trustees, Bill, Melinda, and Warren Buffett. And that's the structure that makes their divorce of public interest. I have no interest myself in speculating on their private lives. But because their governance arrangement for the foundation puts two of them, of the three people that direct the foundation, in charge, what they now decide to do with the foundation has effects on the rest of us, especially the very many of us whose lives are touched by the Gates Foundation's grant making, which is a good portion of the world. And I'll add one final thing, which is that given the scope of the resources that they're, you know, such a large foundation, they have sometimes unanticipated consequences on the global scene. So, for example, the Gates Foundation is committed to building the public health infrastructures, in particular of poor countries, an entirely laudable goal. And what happens sometimes is that the salaries paid by the Gates Foundation to hire local talent siphons off some of the highest, you know, human capital or a brain drain of local talent from public health infrastructures into the Gates Foundation, making it more difficult to build the capacity of the public health infrastructures in the countries where they work.
But if those doctors in those countries stay in those countries, I mean, doesn't that expand total medical capacity?
Well, it depends. The Gates Foundation can't become the global public health infrastructure of the world in perpetuity. So its goal has to be to build capacity in the public health systems of these developing countries and then depart or recede from the scene. And all that I'm pointing to here is a familiar phenomenon of siphoning off talent away from the public health infrastructure into the foundation. And it's an open question what happens downstream. Talent is attracted to work at the Gates Foundation for the reasons of salaries and the opportunity to do good. And a secondary consequence is that there is less talent to work in the public health infrastructure for that time period.
When philanthropists have the kind of money, Rob, that can make a difference, what do you think is the right path for them to get involved in causes? Like, what is your best case scenario for a wealthy do-gooder to make a positive difference?
The best case scenario for philanthropists is to take advantage of the capacity to work on longer time horizons, to fund social experiments that are unlikely to be funded by business and unlikely to be funded by governments. And then when you attach an evidentiary base to the successful experiments, you transfer them humbly to governments for scaling and delivery to all citizens or all people.
Rob Reich is a professor of political science at Stanford University. He's also the author of Just Giving, Why Philanthropy is Failing Democracy and How It Can Do Better. Thank you very much for being with us today, Rob.
Thank you.
At the end of the month, Syria will hold a presidential election. Pollsters are having an easy time calling this one. President Bashar al-Assad is all but guaranteed to win.
We know the Assad regime will attempt to use the Syrian presidential election this May to legitimize its own rule.
That's U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield.
Do not be fooled. These elections will neither be free nor fair and will not be representative of the Syrian people.
Meanwhile, millions of displaced Syrians will also be watching the election news with a fair amount of skepticism. The world's Shirin Jafari spoke with some of them living across the border in Turkey.
The area along Turkey's border with Syria is beautiful this time of year. Drive along the highway and you'll see lush green fields, olive groves and pistachio trees. From time to time, fields of yellow flowers add a splash of color to the landscape. On the Syrian side of the wall that separates the two countries, millions of people remain displaced. They live in camps after Syrian government forces took over their towns with the help of Russia and Iran. Over 80% of the camp residents are women, children, and elderly people, according to the UN. On the Turkish side, where I am, the occasional military vehicle passes by, a reminder of the tense atmosphere around here. Turkish forces have occupied parts of northern Syria since 2019. Next month, as Syria holds an election, thousands of Syrians living on this side of the border will not be taking part. Hello. 40-year-old Samer Haj Khaled was displaced from his home in Idlib at the start of the war in 2011.
In the middle of the garlic field.
Khaled works at a farm near the border. He takes a break from harvesting garlic to sit in the shade and chat with me. Assad must go, Khaled tells me. I will only consider going back to Syria, he says, if Assad is removed from power. People are dying and starving in Syria. I want to go back, but what would I do there? A total of 51 people applied to run in the upcoming election. Syria's highest court accepted three of them. Assad is running again, along with two other men. Seven women had applied as well, but they were rejected by the court. About an hour's drive from the farm is a plastic factory. Its owner, Saad Shuahna, is a 33-year-old businessman from Aleppo, Syria. Shuahna's factory makes plastic containers for medical and cosmetic products. His father started the business in Syria back in the 1980s. Before the civil war, the company did well.
It was a big factory. We were in our sector in top 10.
Before the war, Shuahna moved to Turkey to complete his studies. His family remained in Syria, and his father continued with the business. But the war changed everything.
I was watching the news, and I saw in a news line a plastic factory has been hit, and it was the name of our factory.
His brother and another factory worker were injured. Thankfully, he says no one died. But it wasn't the end of the story. Government forces went after their orchards, thousands of olive and pistachio trees, grapevines that his grandfather had planted. They were all burned down. Shuahna says his father was devastated.
And we were worried about him, all these trees at once. But he didn't okay, I'm done with that. No, he have another 5,000.
His father didn't give up and planted more trees, he says. Eventually, the family decided to flee to Turkey, but Shuahna's father went back to Syria to take care of the trees. On his last trip, 5 months ago, he contracted COVID-19 and died in Syria.
He never left Syria. His soul was there.
All the loss has not changed Shuahna's mind about one thing, that one day he will go back to Syria. Is that realistic, I ask?
My father, when he planted the trees, He didn't plan it for himself. He planned it for us. And maybe we can't go to Syria, but maybe our children will do this. Look at the history and read about the history. No dictator, no regime will last forever.
As for the presidential election coming up, Shahna says it's a joke. Bashar al-Assad won the last presidential election with roughly 99% of the vote. That was in 2014. It will be the same this time around, Shahna says. We already know who's going to win. For The World, Shirin Jafari, Gaziantep, Turkey.
In just 80 days, Japan is set to host the Tokyo Olympics. Notably in Japan, there are no national anti-discrimination laws protecting the LGBTQ community. And according to Olympic Charter rules, discrimination of any kind is explicitly banned at the Games, including discrimination based on sexual orientation. For years, Japanese activists, politicians, and athletes have been trying to change that. Now they're hoping to get the LGBT Equality Act passed into law before the Games begin. Here's The World's Bianca Hillier.
There have been similar bills brought to Japan's parliament before, but this movement is gaining more traction than previous attempts.
More than 100,000 people from and out of Japan have called on the Japanese government to introduce LGBT Equality Act.
Kanai Doi is the Japan director for Human Rights Watch, one of more than 100 human rights organizations taking part in this effort. On top of increased public support, Doi says a court ruling back in March also helped their case. Same-sex marriage is illegal in Japan, but a Sapporo court ruled that not allowing same-sex couples to marry was unconstitutional.
This was a very big win because this was the first time that the Japanese judiciary spoke up about same-sex marriage.
This ruling didn't explicitly help advance the anti-discrimination bill, but Doi says it signaled a broader shift in views to parliament. And last week, the head of the upcoming Olympics, Seiko Hashimoto, visited Japan's first LGBTQ center in Tokyo.
2020 Tokyo 大会というものが振り返った後に
Hashimoto told Reuters, "When we look back on Tokyo 2020, I want people to think it was a turning point for diversity, unity, and understanding LGBTQ people. So we need to take action now." Chris Kinney, a retired U.S. Olympian, agrees. Kinney is part Japanese. After college, he ran track in Japan and loved it. But then someone found out he's bisexual, and the harassment began.
It was pretty intense. I would get hundreds of messages a night just harassing me. And I spent almost 2 years just always looking over my shoulder, completely paranoid.
One morning, Kinney woke up to slashed tires and graffiti on his car.
They spray painted on the side of my car. And then in Japanese, kuso gay, which is like effing gay. And like komo ranna, which is like gay athlete or gay runner.
Kinney says police wouldn't help him. He had to get a new number and move apartments. Because of experiences like this, Kinney is dedicated to getting the LGBT Equality Act passed in Japan.
The country that I love so much, I really hope can step up on this front.
Right now, two different bills have been drafted for submission to the House of Representatives. One is from a group of opposition parties, and it specifically calls for protections against discrimination based on gender identity and sexual orientation. The other bill is from the ruling party, and it's less comprehensive. It calls on companies and schools to promote understanding of LGBTQ people, but it doesn't set penalties for non-compliance, nor does it provide protections against discrimination. Last week, politicians from both sides of the aisle gathered for what they called a rainbow parliament event to show support. Kaneko Otsuji is an openly gay lawmaker from the main opposition party of Japan. She said she was a target of bullying at school and was often called a manly girl. Otsuji said, many people cannot speak up because of fear of discrimination. For the children of the next generation to not face this kind of bullying, we need anti-discrimination laws. Ruling party politician Karen Makishima also spoke. She assured the LGBTQ community that she's working within her party to get protections codified into law. Kanai Doi, from Human Rights Watch in Japan, is hopeful that Parliament will introduce those protections in time for the Games. If the bill does not pass, she says a boycott is not at stake.
But still, I mean, we would call on the Japanese government that you are not fulfilling the obligations under the Olympic Charter.
Members of the Japanese parliament will vote on the LGBT Equality Act in June. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
COVAX, the global coronavirus vaccine program for low- and middle-income countries, it got a boost today from U.S. biotech firm Moderna, a serious boost. That story features in our newsletter, Top of the World. Read more about the additional 500 million doses for COVAX by signing up at theworld.org/newsletters. 10 years and counting, that's how long the civil war has been going on in Syria. What began as a peaceful uprising against President Bashar al-Assad has now left an estimated 600,000 people dead or missing. Many Syrians now live in cities, large parts of which are rubble. We want to focus on the eventual rebuilding. Marwa al-Sabuni is an architect living in Homs, Syria's third largest city, and has just published a book called Building for Hope, Towards an Architecture of Belonging. Marwa, Homs, your city, your home, it became something of a symbol of the destruction in Syria. I'm wondering if you've seen any efforts at rebuilding yet, and what has struck you so far about how that's going?
Well, no rebuilding in a real sense has begun in any part of Syria. But if we are speaking about Homs, it's all about patching up people on their private endeavors, some renovation or some repairing. But on an official aspect, there is no real effort towards rebuilding whatsoever.
So in your book, Building for Hope, you talk about how to frame the re-envisioning of a city's architecture. The question you say should not be how our city should look, but rather how they should make us feel. Talk about that as a design strategy for Homs. Like in your mind, in your wildest imagination, what do you want Homs to feel like? How do you start thinking about that vision?
For my city, I don't need my wildest imagination. I just need to look at the priorities at the moment. We have so many people who are displaced. We need to, of course, provide housing for those people. The nature of the city is completely destroyed. So the river that used to go through the city needs rehabilitation. The orchards that provided income and provided food for the people also struggling. And there is a lot to repair, of course.
Marwa, your premise is that design, especially for these places that we call home, I mean, it's got to be intentional. We saw how fascism in Italy during the war, during World War II, and how the government used brutalism as a way to impress upon people its power. So do you impose a design scheme from up above and tell everyone to follow, or do you let the public decide how they want to live, how they want to build, and risk design chaos?
Obviously, nobody in their right mind wants to impose a fascist design process on people. And you want the feedback of the public and you want to include the needs and the aspiration of people. But what we as architects, we tend to overlook a feeling, which is belonging. And there is a real loss of the sense of belonging and the sense of neighborliness, not only in countries that are struggling like my own country, but also on a global level. The sense of homelessness is not only related to war now, it's also related to our modern life. We no longer belong to our cities and places.
So I really appreciated the conversations in your book between you and your daughter, whom you describe as a millennial. I mean, she believes a place like Dubai is the gold standard. She would seem to represent a lot of people who like clean lines and smooth surfaces where things are efficient. I mean, how do you explain what your vision of rebuilding a city is to her?
I know that she has this infatuation with the modern life and with what the consumer approach that we take on towards life in our times. But what I try to do is to show her, as my city showed me, that there is more to life than this model, and it's a destructive model. It's not a healthy thing to have cities that revolve around materialism and about inequality and injustice, as we see in the Gulf, as we see in America as well. So it's our job as designers and as architects and builders, and also as citizens, to choose what those buildings that and those ideals that speak to our values and to our tastes and the conversation that is deeper than the material aspect that we are facing in a model like the Gulf model.
I'm curious, Marwa, why did you become an architect? How did you think that profession could help you help change the world?
Well, I have no dreams of changing the whole world, of course. I mean, it's enough for me to change my city or to change the reality that I see unfolding in front of my eyes day in and day out since the beginning of this war. My biggest dream is to see my country healing from this war. And I think we are not too far away from the solution. There are many strategies that were applied in our history. It has offered the humanity. Our history is full of those lessons. And I found many insights by going through that history and examine those which I offer in the book.
Marwa Al-Sabouni is an architect and author of the just-published Building for Hope, Towards an Architecture of Belonging. Marwa spoke with us from her home in Homs, Syria. Thank you very much. It was great to meet you.
Thank you so much.
Finally today, if you have a lawn, this may have happened to you. You're out with a lawnmower and a big rock gets in the way. You toss it aside and keep on mowing. For a Belgian farmer who did something like this, it created an international border dispute. It all started when a local history buff, Jean-Pierre Chopin, was out walking one day, and he noticed something odd.
Elle était adossée ici, la borne, et maintenant elle se retrouve là.
In a video posted by French newspaper La Voix du Nord, Chopin explains that he came across a historic boundary marker that had shifted something like 8 feet. It had been moved. Now, these markers are not ornamental. When they were installed in the early 1800s, the stones marked new international borders agreed upon at the end of the Napoleonic Wars. So by moving a stone some 200 years later just to get his tractor by, this farmer had redrawn the border. Alert the authorities, or the local mayor. David Laveau, the mayor of the Belgian village of Erquilin, spoke to the French TV channel TF1 about the incident.
Il a réduit la France et... C'est pas une bonne idée.
He reduced the size of France, and that's not a good idea. It could create a diplomatic incident.
As for the farmer at the center of this dispute, he was apparently just annoyed that the stone was in his tractor's path. So he tossed it into France. His intention was not to reclaim territory, even if Belgian Mayor David Laveau says he himself was not upset by the outcome.
Moi, j'étais content, ma commune était plus grande, mais...
Me, I was happy. My town was a little bit bigger. The mayor of Bousigny-sur-Roc doesn't agree, though.
Not exactly true. His French counterpart, Mayor Aurélie Wellonec, also seemed mostly unperturbed. She said she expects the dispute to be resolved. The farmer will simply be asked to put the marker back where it used to be. If he doesn't do that, the foreign ministers of France and Belgium might actually have to get involved. So, a word to the wise... Next time you're tending your garden, be careful, especially if you live near a border or a local history buff. The World comes to you from the Nana Bill Harris Studio in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. You be safe, stay strong. We'll see you tomorrow.